for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Helen Simonson is a 46-year-old first-time novelist whose comedy of contemporary manners is titled Major Pettigrew's Last Stand. It's the story of two mature, widowed people who assume they're done with love. One is a stiff, upper-lipped English major. The other is a shop owner of Pakistani descent. They find they have much in common, but are confronted by bigotry and cultural expectations from both sides of their idyllic English village. Helen Simonson joins me in the studio. She was born in England, spent her teenage years living in East Sussex. She's a graduate of the London School of Economics, a former travel advertising executive. She's lived here in America for the last two decades. And as I said earlier, this is her first novel. And I want to congratulate you, Helen. It's wonderful.
Thank you, Diane, and thank you for having me.
My pleasure. You know, I looked at the cover of this book, and I hope we can put the cover up on the website because it's such a special one. What it has is a coat stand, a vertical coat stand, wooden coat stand, with coats on either side, one male, one female, one hat at the top, one hat at the other side. And I realize it is a cover of Life magazine, which appeared in 1924. It's just marvelous. Did you have anything to do with that?
No, the cover is an area of separate expertise. There's a whole department at my publisher's Random House. They worked very hard on it. We went through several kinds of cover because this book is many things. It's a comedy of social manners. It's a love story. There are many ways that one could pitch it. And there was strong feeling at Random House, especially among their national sales department, which met at a conference, that this was a very classic book, and they were looking for something with a classic cover, which I was thrilled about, instant gravitas.
I should say.
And when they showed me this illustration, I was just blown away.
Thrilled.
I think it's lovely.
Me
and
too.
I'm very, very proud of it.
Tell me what inspired this novel.
Well, I was in an MFA program at Stony Brook Southampton College, and I was desperate to be a published writer, and that involves trying to write mostly short stories for literary magazines in the hope of getting published. And I was writing very gritty, edgy, contemporary stories because I thought that's what it took. And one day I picked up one of the magazines I would have dearly loved to be in, and I read an extremely gritty short story. It was construction workers in L.A., and on their lunch hour they would pick up ladies of ill repute for a little action under the highway overpasses. And I put this magazine very carefully aside, and I said to myself, well, I guess that's it. I guess I'm not going to be a writer, because even if I could compete with that, that is not my view of the world. I'm done trying to describe the world by its edges. It's not what I believe. I'm not enjoying myself. What if I wrote something just for me? And that was a moment of clarity for which I'll be forever grateful, because I sat down and I was a little concerned because what came out was an English village and a man wearing his dead wife's house coat. And there were a lot of roses around the door. And I thought, oh my gosh, nobody is going to like this. How will I even present it to my professor? And the strangest thing happened. I took in what was essentially a short story. The first chapter was a short story. And when he gave me back my pages, he was beaming. And he said, there's a spark here that I haven't seen. I think you found your novel.
Oh, how wonderful. would you read for us from the beginning so our listeners can get a sense of it?
Lovely, thank you. Major Pettigrew was still upset about the phone call from his brother's wife, and so he answered the doorbell without thinking. On the damp bricks of the path stood Mrs. Ali from the village shop. She gave only the faintest of starts, the merest arch of an eyebrow. A quick rush of embarrassment flooded to the major's cheeks, and he smoothed helplessly at the lap of his crimson, clematis-covered housecoat with hands that felt like spades. "Ah," he said. "Major? Mrs. Ali?" There was a pause that seemed to expand slowly, like the universe, which, he had just read, was pushing itself apart as it aged. Senescence, they had called it in the Sunday paper. "I came for the newspaper money. The paper boy is sick," said Mrs. Ali, drawing up her short frame to its greatest height and assuming a brisk tone, so different from the low, accented roundness of her voice when they discussed the texture and perfume of the teas she blended specially for him. "Of course, I'm awfully sorry." He had forgotten to put the week's money in an envelope under the outside doormat. He started fumbling for the pockets of his trousers, which were somewhere under the clematis. He felt his eyes watering. His pockets were inaccessible unless he hoisted the hem of the housecoat. "I'm sorry," he repeated. "Oh, not to worry," she said, backing away. "You can drop it in at the shop later, sometime more convenient." She was already turning away when he was seized with an urgent need to explain. "My brother died," he said. She turned back. "My brother died," he repeated. "I got the call this morning. I didn't have time." The dawn chorus had still been chattering in the giant yew against the west wall of his cottage, the sky pink, when the telephone rang. The major, who had been up early to do his weekly house cleaning, now realized he had been sitting in a daze ever since. He gestured helplessly at his strange outfit and wiped a hand across his face. Quite suddenly his knees felt loose, and he could sense the blood leaving his head. He felt his shoulder meet the doorpost unexpectedly, and Mrs. Ali, quicker than his eye could follow, was somehow at his side, propping him upright. "I think we'd better get you indoors and sitting down," she said, her voice soft with concern. "If you'll allow me, I will fetch you some water." Since most of the feeling seemed to have left his extremities, the major had no choice but to comply. Mrs. Ali guided him across the narrow, uneven stone floor of the hallway and deposited him in the wing chair tucked just inside the door of the bright, book-lined living room. It was his least favourite chair, lumpy cushioned and with a hard ridge of wood at just the wrong place on the back of his head, but he was in no position to complain.
And that was Helen Simonson reading from her brand new novel. It's titled Major Pettigrew's Last Stand. You can join us if you like, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. You can also join us on Facebook and Twitter. Do you think, Helen Simonson, that it was love at first sight?
I think the major and Mrs. Ali, who had known each other for 6 years, had completely failed to realize that there was any connection between themselves because of the relative positions they were in the village. And I'm very interested in this theme because I think we all do this all the time. We know people from work, or we know the man in the store down the street, and we see them as their job. We see them in their context, and we have great difficulty, I believe, in seeing people outside of context, seeing them for the individuals they are. And so I like to think that the major and Mrs. Ali were better friends all along than they knew.
Here she was blending these teas just for him.
Yes, and he was born in Lahore, Pakistan, where his father was serving in the British Army. And I think he could appreciate her tea blending in a way that most of the other people in the village could not.
And, of course, he had been a widow for 6 years. She had been a widow for how long?
For about 18 months.
Uh-huh. So hers was a more fresh grief, perhaps, than his.
Absolutely. And then I think when his brother died, she was in a position to empathize immediately. And what I loved and what came particularly easily was that momentary faintness that allowed her literally to put her foot over a threshold where she would normally have never been invited. Not that he was a horrible person who didn't like her. It would just not
compassion,
have occurred to either of them.
Of course.
Compassion opened the
compassion.
Door.
Compassion. And do you know the look of that house?
Oh, I had the greatest fun making up all the houses and most of the locations in this book. I guess I'm very fond of architecture, and I did allow myself the self-indulgence of kind of creating my perfect village house. It's actually a lodge. It's Rose Lodge. And so it's slightly bigger than a cottage, a little mellow brick, some extensions, perhaps during Georgian times, to give it perhaps a larger living room than a cottage might have. And, of course, a wonderful and slightly frowsy English garden all around it. Mm. I would like to live there.
Helen Simonson, her new novel, her first, is titled Major Pettigrew's Last Stand. When we come back, you'll hear more about both the Major and Mrs. Ali. We'll take your calls, your email. Do join us. Helen Simonson, I know you grew up in a small commuter town of London, Sussex, and you've spoken about it as sort of the English dream. Describe it for us.
Yes, I actually grew up in a suburb of Slough, which was not a terribly attractive place, very, very post-war modern. Sir John Betjeman wrote a famous poem that said, "Come friendly bombs and fall on Slough. It isn't fit for humans now. There isn't grass to grow a cow." And so I grew up in this very modern post-war area. And then when I was approaching 15, we moved to East Sussex. And this is the English dream, to move to a detached house in the country. And we were able to move to a very small house in a very picturesque village just outside the smuggling town of Rye. Rye is a conical-shaped town on a hill. Most of the buildings date from the 14th century, and some of those were rebuilt in 1450, you'll see on the Mermaid Inn. And it's just stunningly beautiful countryside. And I was an impressionable teenage girl, obviously of romantic tendencies, and I was just blown away by the countryside. And obviously after 20 years of living mostly in New York, I still haven't lost my love for that countryside. And it's very, very close in my mind all the time.
What's interesting to me is that in this charming village in which the mayor lives, there is this shop that Mrs. Ali and her nephew, who stepped in after her husband died, they operate this little shop. Describe the shop for us.
Well, what's very interesting about the shop is it's very ugly. And I wanted to make it clear that in the middle of all very, very attractive British villages, there are usually ugly shops, because we have to modernize. There has to be some progress, and that usually means taking out some lovely Victorian bowed window and putting in plate glass. But most of our villages wouldn't survive without some kind of village shop, because for years public transportation has been very difficult. Maybe the bus goes to town every couple of hours, as it does in my book. And so you need a village shop where you can run in and get milk and newspapers and your sausages and baked beans, and also catch up on the village gossip.
But at the same time, you have a great many people who live within the village who go out of their way to avoid this little shop. They will wait for that bus or drive the hour it takes to the next large store. Why is that?
Well, Britain is not necessarily welcoming of people who are British and who are perhaps even second generation or even third generation immigrants from the rest of our colonies. They were part of our Commonwealth, and now they're British citizens, but we're no better than anyone else at accepting outsiders. And the way I wrote it in the book was that the village had mostly come to accept the situation, and they had gotten tired of driving 4 miles for a lottery ticket, and so they had been reduced to coming into the shop. And I also wrote that the higher echelons of village society had taken the opposite tack of suggesting that they were now a multicultural utopia, because they had this lovely Pakistani couple in the shop, and so they would actually make a point of coming in and being terribly, terribly condescending, no doubt, to Mr. and Mrs. Ali, who were very patient.
And then when Mr. Ali dies, the nephew steps in and sort of tries to take over.
Well, I think the expectations of Mr. Ali's family would be that his widow would return to the bosom of the larger family, and they're in a northern city, leaving the next generation of men to take over the business. And that's a model that's been very successful in England and seems perfectly reasonable, until you realize that in Mrs. Ali's case, it will mean giving up the freedom that the shop has allowed her.
There is, about Major Pettigrew, an internal voice, a dialogue he goes through in almost every encounter. You hear him thinking to himself. You hear his real reactions, and then you realize they're almost always suppressed.
Yes, I like the idea of a character who doesn't say much, and that would be an English trait that people have commented on, that we seem very taciturn and not as effusive, perhaps, as our American cousins. But I was very interested. I started this novel, and it was in the major's head, and there came a point, maybe 50 or 100 pages in, where you have to decide if you're sticking with him or you're going into somebody else's head for the next 200 pages. And I thought it would be an incredible challenge to try to stay with one character and see the world through his eyes. And that required a lot of explaining what was going on in his head. And I really enjoyed that.
I
had fun with it.
I bet you did. The interesting development is how different his son Roger is from the major. What is it with Roger?
Well, Roger is approaching 30 and he's a financier in the City of London, and he's struggling to make his way into the big leagues. And I think he feels somewhat limited by his background, in that his father is this country major and perhaps there's a little money behind the family, but not as much as perhaps some of the other people he's working alongside. I think he represents today's kind of urban, a successful or aspiring successful person. I've lived in New York 20 years. My husband's been on Wall Street a long time.
We're part of that too.
And I don't pretend not to be that type myself. I take delight, people hate Roger, and I take delight in saying that he's my non-fiction character, and some of the worst things he comes out with, things like asking if his father would like a phone with large buttons because he's elderly. These are things I may have suggested to my own parents who are not even yet in their declining years. And my father was very quick to tell me what I could do with my concerns about their age. So I really, really enjoy Roger.
You enjoy the creation of Roger. What about Roger's, quote, fiance?
Oh, I adored her. And I have to say, this is my first experience of writing a novel. So you could do 50 pages and then you do 100 pages and then you realize you have no idea what you're doing and where you're going to go. And Sandy, the American, definitely started out as being somewhat shallow, somewhat a stereotype. And I grew to love her, too, and to realize that there were depths behind what she was trying to do.
Oh, yes.
And actually, she and even Roger, there's a certain amount of pathos behind young people struggling in a world that demands that you make it or get out of town. And so by two-thirds of the way through the novel, I had a certain amount of compassion for both of them. But I was having way too much fun making Roger horrible to actually let that compassion show.
I felt early on that Roger was greedy and grubby, that shortly after the major's brother died, here comes Roger asking about these gorgeous Churchill guns. Tell us about those guns.
Yes. What's very funny in the book is the major's father has this pair of amazing guns that were presented to him by a Maharaja for an act of bravery in the closing days before partition of India. And on the father's death, he gave one to each son, because how could he choose between his sons? And so he threw primogeniture out the window and gave them one each. And the understanding was that whoever died first, then the guns would be reunited, because it was still important to the whole family that the patrimony continue. And what happens is that Bertie, the brother who dies, forgets to write anything concrete in his will. And so this understanding in the family is merely a family understanding. And legally, the widow has rights to dispose of the guns. And if they're not going to be reunited, Roger sees no reason why perhaps his own father shouldn't sell his own gun, because after all, he's an elderly man. Why does he need such a valuable sporting gun? And Roger could really use the money. And the widow's daughter, Jemima, could really use the money because she has private school to pay for. And so everybody wants to get a piece of the gun. And what's very funny to me is everybody loves the major, and everybody can really get behind the fact that he wants to reunite this family heirloom and see it continue. But what he actually wants to do is take something that's not legally his. And I had a great deal of fun with that, trying to walk that line between having everybody rooting for the major to have the guns while understanding that actually he's not legally entitled to them.
Helen Simonson, the book we're talking about is titled Major Pettigrew's Last Stand. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Helen, tell us a little more about you. You've had an interesting career. I mean, going to the London School of Economics, and here you are, with your passion writing your first novel?
Well, I was always interested in writing, and I have to say, as a child, my parents were very proud of my writing and very supportive, and they thought it was a wonderful thing to do on the weekends, but that one should go out and get a real job. And so I went off to university to study economics and politics with a view to perhaps the diplomatic service or becoming a politician. And my parents had both been local councillors, and they were the kind of councillors who filled potholes and got youth centres built and put up gazebos in the town square so that the community could come together. And I got to university and found within about 6 months that politics was more the art of the backroom deal. And, I understand one has to make trades. And it was not the idealistic world that I was anticipating. And I found that I spent most of my time in university in various clubs being the publicity director.
Oh, dear. Oh, dear.
And I enjoyed it. I loved it. And so when I came out of college, I actually got a job in an ad agency as a copywriter. And I'd already met my husband and married him and came to New York and got a job more on the executive side of advertising. Worked for a cruise line as their advertising director and had a blast doing that. I love to help people travel. I think travel is an incredibly important part of life. We should all go out and do it. So that was a lot of fun. And then I had my first child and took 12 weeks maternity leave, and at the end of 11 weeks said, well, what happens now? Because I had been fully planning to hire a nanny and go back to the office, and at the end of 11 weeks it was like, you are not going to pry this baby out of my hands.
Interesting.
And what were we thinking? My husband and I wanted to have it all, but he was a busy banker. He never came home before 8 o'clock at night, and I was a busy advertising executive, never came home before 8 o'clock at night. And you suddenly look down at your bundle of joy and think, well, what were we thinking?
Well, exactly.
Should we leave him with a ham sandwich?
So
I decided to stay home.
Good for you.
And I've worked a little part-time here and there, but I've been a very happy stay-at-home mother. And then I did look for some creative outlet, because being a stay-at-home mother is a full-time blue-collar and white-collar job, but you need an outside activity.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. I love the way you put that it's a full-time blue-collar, white-collar job.
Oh, 1 minute you need a PhD in child development, and the next minute you're cleaning up something very sticky off the floor. And it's a 24/7 job. It's the worst kind of shift work around.
How old is your child now?
I have two boys, and they, yesterday and today, they turned 17 and 15.
Oh, how terrific.
It's been a while.
How terrific. All right, we've got a number of callers, so let's open the phones, 800-433-8850. Let's go to San Antonio, Texas. Good morning, John. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. Good morning, Helen.
Good morning.
I just wanted to say, just being about to finish Sense and Sensibility for the first time, something about what you're saying put the hook in me, and I downloaded a copy onto my Kindle, and I'm really looking forward to it.
How about that? That's terrific. I think you're going to enjoy it, John.
I'm sure I will.
Okay.
You never scared me wrong in the past.
I'm glad to hear that. Thanks for calling to Salt Lake City. And to Nancy, you're on the air.
Thank you. The man just before me stole what I was going to say.
You're reading Sense and Sensibility?
No. I was hooked, right after, just during your reading, and when you stopped, it was like, oh, don't stop. Keep going. Being a psychologist and a very curious and nosy person, I want to know what happened.
Well,
and I wanted to tell you, you are delightful, Helen, and you've inspired me to quit writing stuff and then sticking it on a shelf or leaving it in a notebook. I think I'll finish something, because I love my characters, too. And I think I was married to that son. And I'm so glad I'm not. It just reminded me how happy I am.
Well,
thank you so much.
And Nancy, thanks for calling. I hope you do continue to write what's in your heart and what you know. Isn't that always what people say?
It is, but, you know, it takes a long time to come to that realization. I was writing for at least 5 years before I had this moment of clarity where I said, I'm going to go with my own voice. It's very hard, especially when you get into a writing program. You really, really, really want to be Chekhov, or you really, really want to be Virginia Woolf. And sometimes that means that you suppress your own voice and you try to be very severe and literary and experimental. And it takes a lot to go with your own voice because your own voice may not be that high literary bar you're aiming for.
Your own voice in this book is so accessible and so filled with clarity. I think everyone's going to enjoy it. Helen Simonson, and we're talking about her new novel, her very first. It's titled Major Pettigrew's Last Stand.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, supporting the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse. By The Economist, covering news and ideas from around the world and the connections between them on newsstands, iPhone, and iPad, and at The Economist Online. And by Plowshares Fund, dedicated to helping build a safe, secure, and nuclear weapon-free world at plowshares.org. This is NPR.
They co-founded Newman's Own Food Line and a free camp for seriously ill children. Writer A.E. Hotchner and Hollywood icon Paul Newman were friends for over a half century. Recollections of off-screen adventures with the late actor, The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. And we're back. Since one of our callers said she was disappointed when you stopped reading, how about giving us another taste and set this up for us, if you would?
Thank you. Well, this is well into the book. The major has invited Mrs. Ali to the annual golf club dance, the theme of which is an evening at the Mughal court. So this would be a South Asian theme, perhaps not something that he really should bring a lady of Pakistani descent to. But he's going to his friend Grace's house, thinking that he's bringing them both to the party. Straightening his bow tie and giving a final tug to his dinner jacket, the major knocked on the insubstantial plywood of Grace's mock Georgian front door. It was Mrs. Ali who opened it, the light spilling out onto the step around her and her face in partial shadow. She smiled, and he thought he detected the shine of lipstick. "Major, won't you come in?" she said, and turned away in a breathless, hurried manner. Her back, receding towards the front room, was partly revealed against the deep swoop of an evening dress. Under a loosely tied chiffon wrap, her shoulder blades were sharply delineated, and her bronze skin glowed between the dark stuff of the dress and the low bun at the nape of her neck. In the front room, she half pirouetted on the hearthrug, and the folds of the dress billowed around her ankles and came to rest on the tips of her shoes. It was a dark blue dress of silk velvet. The deeply cut décolletage was partially hidden by the sweep of the chiffon wrap, but Mrs. Ali's collarbones were exquisitely visible several inches above the neckline. The material fell over a swell of bosom to a loosely gathered midriff where an antique diamond brooch sparkled. "Is Grace still getting ready, then?" he asked, unable to trust himself to comment on her dress and yet unwilling to look away. "No, Grace had to go early and help with the setup. Mrs. Green picked her up a short while ago. I'm afraid it's just me." Mrs. Ali almost stammered, and a blush crept into her cheekbones. The Major thought she looked like a young girl. He wished he was still a boy, with a boy's impetuous nature. A boy could be forgiven a clumsy attempt to launch a kiss, but not, he feared, a man of thinning hair and faded vigour. "I could not be happier," said the Major. Being also stuck on the problem of how to handle the two drooping roses in his hand, he held them out. "Is one of those for Grace? I could put it in a vase for her." He opened his mouth to say that she looked extremely beautiful and deserved armfuls of roses, but the words were lost in committee somewhere, shuffled aside by the parts of his head that worked full-time on avoiding ridicule. "Wilted a bit, I'm afraid," he said. "Colour's all wrong for the dress anyway." "Do you like it?" she said, turning her eyes down to the fabric. "I lent Grace an outfit, and she insisted that I borrow something of hers in fair trade." "Very beautiful," he said. "It belonged to Grace's great-aunt, who was considered quite fast, and who lived alone in Baden-Baden," she says, "with two blind terriers and a succession of lovers." She looked up again, her eyes anxious. "I hope the shawl is enough. You look perfect." "I feel quite naked, but Grace told me you always wear a dinner jacket, so I wanted to wear something to go with what you're wearing." She smiled, and the Major felt more years melt away from him. The boy's desire to kiss her welled up again. "Besides," she added, "a shawar camise is not exactly a costume for me." The Major reached a spontaneous compromise with himself and reached for her hand. He raised it to his lips and closed his eyes while kissing her knuckles. She smelled of rose water and some spicy clean scent that might, he thought, be lime blossom. When he opened his eyes, her head was turned away, but she did not try to pull her hand from his grasp. "I hope I've not offended you," he said. "Man is rash in the face of beauty." "I am not offended," she said, "but perhaps we had better go to the dance." "If we must," said the Major, giving a stubborn push past the fear of ridicule, "though anyone would be just as content to sit and gaze at you across this empty room all evening." "If you insist on paying me such lavish compliments, Major," said Mrs. Ali, blushing again, "my conscience will force me to change into a large black jumper and perhaps a wool hat." "In that case, let us leave immediately so we can put that horrible option out of reach," he said.
How wonderful. All right, we'll go right back to the phones to Inverness, Florida. Good morning, Donna. You're on the air.
Oh, hello, Diane. I am thrilled to be able to talk to you. I read your book last summer, and anyway, I'm driving, grinning from ear to ear, listening to your guest, Helen, because of her spirit. Her joy at every stage of life moves me to tears right now, and her choice of her children over other options. And I'm so thrilled that she's putting that spirit in writing for all of us. And I'm encouraged at 65. I have a few books in my mind, not fiction, but she's encouraging me to pursue my own dreams.
Donna, good for you. Go for it.
Okay. Thank you both.
Thanks for calling. Isn't that lovely?
It is, and I would encourage everybody to write. I think what I found, and I've basically been writing 12 years, and I've been in an MFA program that attracts a lot of older people as well as recent undergraduates. It's something that local people can come in at any stage in life and pick up. And I found that it gives a wonderful depth to the program. And people who come in at all stages of life are able, perhaps better than the very young, recent college graduate, to find their own way in writing. They don't necessarily have to be Hemingway or Virginia Woolf. They find that they're really good at doing local news, or they find that they're really good at doing a small memoir about their family. They're more willing to explore all the options in writing rather than insist on being, you know, the angry young voice of a generation, something like that.
Are you going to travel around the country to talk about this book?
I'll go anywhere I'm invited.
That's great. Let's go now to Austin, Texas. Good morning, Anne.
Good morning. This is the most delightful, fabulous, wonderful conversation. I've been sitting here at my dining room table drinking coffee and laughing out loud. and I'm about to rush off to Book People, our wonderful local bookstore, and buy this immediately. I'm a great Anglophile. I spent a lot of time in England back in the good old days when the dollar was strong and the pound was weak. Are you old enough to remember one?
Oh.
So I can't wait to really get to know these people. I mean, man is rash in the face of beauty. How beautiful. How marvelous.
Well, thanks for calling in. I'm sure you're going to enjoy it.
Oh, I'm going to love it. Let me just ask one quick question.
Sure.
You were talking about writing. I'm a widow, and I have written a very funny book about what it's like to be a widow at my third age, and it's called If He Can Sit Up and Feed Himself, because at one point I said I would go out with anybody as long as they could, you know. But I can't get it published. If you join a writing group, does that help perhaps to open the door, or do you have any helpful hints?
Okay, helpful hints. My biggest hint is that it's all about the work. So if you're having difficulty getting it published, the first thing I would suggest is that you find a workshop or a local teacher who's willing to give you blunt advice, because there may be a way, maybe there's a little tweak that you're missing. Maybe the material is great, but it could use some condensing in the middle or a hook in the front or something like that. And I found that giving it to other people to read and being willing to take very blunt advice is
that's
the best thing.
That's the hard part, isn't
taking
it?
Taking the advice is hard. It took me many years to be able to take advice. I was fortunate that I developed early on a very nice writing group in Brooklyn. We're now a decades-old writing group of
How
women
wonderful.
Who trade pages.
Yeah.
And we're very blunt.
Now, tell me about your own role as immigrant to this country and how that might have affected your portrayal of Mrs. Ali.
Well, I guess I'm very interested in the role of the outsider in society. I also believe that all of us at one time or another in our lives have probably experienced what it feels like to be on the outside. I'm very fortunate. I'm very welcomed in the United States. People love that British accent. And I have many, many friends here and have never been put on the outside. And what interested me in Mrs. Ali is here's someone who, though she's older than me, is British, born and bred, raised to be an English woman with a father who really believed in Britain. And yet she's permanently branded an outsider because of her ethnic heritage. And that continues to be an issue in England. And I wanted to write a book that just gently said to people, you know, next time you see Mrs. Ali coming down the street, perhaps you might want to put aside the stereotype and say hello, have a cup of tea.
Indeed.
I'm a big believer in a cup of tea to smooth the way between people. But I do suffer. I don't suffer with an identity problem. I enjoy the fact that I have two homes, that I'm very at home in the United States and also very proud of being an English woman.
But you also say you and your husband are old house people. What does that mean?
Well, we are. I think we were betrayed into this when we were a young couple. My husband's older brother and his wife had an antique farmhouse up in New Hampshire, which they still have. And we would go up there to visit, and they would have their copies of Old House Journal. And if you've read like 10 years of back copies of Old House Journal, you become convinced that you can renovate old houses with a chisel and some paint stripper. And my husband and I bought an old house in Brooklyn. We were young and foolish. We had $50 a month to renovate. And at closing, the realtor could not believe we were moving in. She assumed we had a contractor to gut it. And we moved in with the flaking paint and the sagging ceilings.
Wow.
And we loved it from day one.
And you did it all yourself?
No. It took us about 6 months to realize that we were hopeless at renovating. And so as we could afford it, we found really, really good contractors. And we kind of did one room at a time. Mm. I remember my young son was 6 months old, and I was washing baby bottles in the bathroom because we didn't have a kitchen because it was being built for us. It took about 10 years, and our house was renovated one room at a time. And
now,
you can tell.
Now you live here in Washington.
We do. We moved in this economy. My husband was offered a very good job down here. And so after 17 years in our wonderful Brooklyn Heights house, we made the decision to come down here because being together is more important than holding on to a great old house. We still own it. It's rented by a lovely international family who are somewhat in the same boat because of the economy. They've got offered a great job in New York and moved from Europe. So we all shuffled one house to the left. And here I'm up in Bethesda in a brand new house. And it took me a while to get used to it. To be honest, I complained about how new it was and how big it was. And some of the features are maybe unnecessary. It has a lot of spotlights in the living room. But I'm very grateful for it. Now that we've been through Snowmageddon, everything in my house worked and the power stayed on and people were able to come and stay with me because their power had gone out. And so I'm now very grateful for my house.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's go to Grand Rapids, Michigan. Good morning, Denise.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, Diane. I just wanted to say I love your show. I listen to it regularly.
Thank you.
Well, I have three comments. The first one is that I am a bookseller and did read the book and loved it. It's just a wonderful book, and I have been recommending it to everyone. And it's The Sense of Place and just wonderful characters. You know, you just grow to love everyone, even Roger and his girlfriend, by the end of the book, like Helen said. They're wonderful. And also, I just wanted to comment that Helen probably knows this, but independent bookstores all over the country have a list of books that they're recommending, and the book is Major Pettigrew is actually featured on the cover of our Indie Next list for March, which is wonderful.
How terrific. That must give you great pleasure, Helen.
It does. And I have to say, I thought I knew about books, but I didn't know about the book industry. And it was a revelation to me that you hear all the time about independent bookstores struggling, but through the IndieBound organization and the internet, they have kind of coalesced and become this incredible voice. And I can tell them all that publishers pay attention to what they say. And so it was amazing before any of the kind of mainstream reviews came out that booksellers had read advance copies, and it was their voices that launched the success of this book. And yes, I'm the number one IndieBound next pick for March, and I'm absolutely thrilled.
Denise, that must give you great pleasure as well.
Oh, definitely. And I just wanted to say, if they ever make a movie of this, I would love Timothy Dalton as Major Pettigrew.
Oh, I love it. What do you think of that? Have you had any interest shown?
I'm not sure if I'm allowed to say. I wish my agent were here. Okay. Yes, I have had some interest shown, and I will actually be talking to Hollywood at 5:30 p.m. this afternoon from my kitchen table. While making macaroni and cheese for the boys' supper. So.
That must have stunned you.
Oh, it absolutely did, largely because this is a love story with mature protagonists. There isn't really a role for Jennifer Aniston in this, and so there was some concern. And also, it's very difficult. There are lots of wonderful, wonderful books out there, and it's very difficult to get it made into a movie. So we shall see. I'm told a long process and just kind of like a lottery ticket. But I already won the lottery. I got this book published. So from my point of view, anything beyond that is gravy.
How is your husband feeling about this? How are your two sons feeling about it?
My two sons, they're very funny. They're teenagers. They try to appear incredibly unimpressed. They plan to be unimpressed until it is in movie theaters. But in fact, my older son sent me a text that a guy he knew at school was on vacation at Christmas, and his mother's friend was a movie producer, and she was reading my book, Oh My God. And this meant he was totally busted because he had obviously talked about me enough at school that his classmate registered the name and the book name when he saw it. So I very much embarrassed my son by letting him know that I knew he was proud of me.
Well, Helen Simonson, I think those of us who've had the pleasure of reading this can all chime in on that. Congratulations.
Thank
to
you.
It's a wonderful, wonderful book. Major Pettigrew's Last Stand, Helen Simonson is the author. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.